I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with a Deal, and today our guest is Bill Regner, an M&A partner at Debevoise and Plimpton and Newton. Bill, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about your career arc on today's podcast, how you got into the law and how you came to practice in M&A, your interest in Delaware case law, and your focus on investment management transactions and conflicted transactions in your own practice, a little bit about your thoughts on the recent amendments to Delaware's corporate code, and then finally, what you do to decompress from the job. So with that, tell us about yourself and how you came to the practice.
Well, I was a history major in college, which doesn't prepare you for anything in particular, I would say. It might prepare you pretty well for a lot of different things, but it doesn't give you a lot of direction. And I guess I started to think that law school would be a good thing for me because I had the idea that I would be good at being a lawyer. It seemed to me that being a lawyer involved reading and writing and arguing and things that I like to do and thought I could be good at. And so that was really what drew me to it.
And then you were a paralegal between college and law school. Talk about that experience and how it helped orient you when you were in law school.
Well, it certainly helped confirm that I wanted to be a lawyer. I liked being in a law firm environment. I liked being around lawyers. I was in a corporate practice. I did a wide variety of work. Some of that was M&A, but it was also finance. It was capital markets. It was a lot of different things. But I always liked the M&A transactions that I worked on the best as a legal assistant, and I still do. And it did help, I think, to have spent a couple of years working before going to law school, in part because I worked long hours as a paralegal. And so being in school again was a pleasure. The people who went straight through thought law school was hard compared to college, and maybe it is, but it's not hard compared to having an actual job. So that, I think, was a help. And it also, I think, helped direct me toward what I wanted to do in practice when I got out.
And then how did you end up focusing on M&A, which you've done almost your entire career?
Well, when I started at Debevoise, we didn't have the delineation between practice groups that we have today. So I was a corporate associate. I did a lot of M&A, but I continued to do a lot of other kinds of corporate work. I guess the thing that I liked about M&A most was the pace of it. You know, the projects have beginnings and middles and ends that are pretty close together. I liked the fact that it was multidisciplinary. It drew on, you know, lots of different areas of the law. So it rewarded curious people who wanted to learn a lot about not just, you know, contract law, but also capital markets dynamics or securities law or environmental law or tax law, or, you know, you had to pull all these things together as an M&A lawyer. And I liked that part of it.
And one of your mentors at Debevoise was Meredith Brown. Talk about him and how your relationship with him helped shape your approach to being an M&A lawyer.
Meredith Brown was my partner advisor when I was a summer associate, and he was also my partner advisor when I joined the firm as an associate, and he was the head of the M&A group, was the head of the corporate department. He was a formidable presence, a brilliant man, a brilliant lawyer, and taught me a great deal about what I know about being a lawyer and about being a person. He taught me to read everything that, you know, the extent to which just being better prepared than the people you encounter in practice is a huge advantage. He was interested in almost everything. And so he taught me about the rewards of being kind of intellectually venturesome. He taught me that, you know, solving part of a problem was better than not solving any of a problem, which is, you know, seems like an obvious insight, but one that didn't come to me without being taught it. And there's sort of a meta thing that he taught me, which is just how much of an influence one person can have on another. He really did change my life as a professional, as a person. And it was just because he took an interest in me and took the time to teach and spend time with me. And that's just incredibly powerful. And so that's something I've also tried to remember, is that, you know, each of us has that capacity to affect the lives of others coming up.
Which transactions were formative for you when you were an associate? You started as an associate in 1994, where there was a bit of a dip in the M&A market. The economy was in a recession that it quickly emerged from. And the second half of the 90s were a very active period in M&A and the economy generally.
Well, I was hired at a time that certainly was a recession, and there was not a lot of transaction activity. And one of the consequences of that was that I was hired into a very small class. And so when the deal market picked up in the 90s, there were not lots of people to do the work. And that was a great opportunity because, you know, just as a force, we had to take a lot of responsibility, and it enabled me to, you know, to do things at an earlier stage of my career that I might have in a less active or more fully staffed environment. So I don't want to say I was under-supervised, but we were lightly supervised at that time. And I guess one of the clients that I worked with early on was Chrysler, and we represented Chrysler in dealing with, you know, what would come to be called an activist investor in the person of Kirk Kerkorian, who was pressuring Chrysler to pay a great big special dividend because it had a large cash position, you know, the car business being cyclical. And he had banded together with Jerry York, a former CFO of Chrysler, who was going to be a director candidate of Kerkorian's. And this was before the advent of activism, but it sounded a lot of the themes that you'd hear from activists about how companies ought to manage their balance sheet. And so anyway, that was an important early exposure to that world, I would say. And then we also represented Chrysler when it was merged with Daimler in 1998. And that was a really challenging transaction because there was no obvious way to combine a German company and an American company. And so we spent untold hours in conference rooms with whiteboards just trying to figure out a structure that would combine the companies and not expose the U.S. shareholders to lots of legal proceedings in Germany challenging the values at which the companies had combined. That was also kind of a marquee transaction, but also just an intense effort as a sort of mid-level or senior associate.
Because as I remember, the German corporate law at the time was antiquated. It would have been a little like taking an American company in the mid-1990s, which is essentially like an American company would be today from a legal perspective, and merging it with an American company from, say, 1890.
Well, I think one of the things that people don't talk about cross-border work that much is that a lot of the differences between legal regimes are just kind of accidental. They're not by design. I don't think it was anybody decided that it was a good idea to make it hard to combine a German company with a non-German company. So a lot of the challenges really were technical, I would say. But, you know, the issue in that deal was that Germany had an appraisal-like proceeding that was different from the U.S. appraisal proceedings, in that if there was an appraisal award, it was in favor of all the shareholders, not just the ones pursuing it. And so that represented a huge risk in a stock merger, that you would end up having some German court second guess the exchange ratio at the expense of the former U.S. shareholders. So that was really the biggest technical challenge for us.
And then you became a partner in 2002. Talk about how your practice evolved at that point.
Well, I've continued to do a lot of the things that I've done throughout my career. That's the focus on public company work. It's a focus on conflict transactions and a bit of an industry focus in investment management and in media, telecom. I think the way that the practice has evolved a bit is, even though I have focused on public company work, the world of private equity has intersected with it to a large extent. And so I find myself either opposite or on the side of private equity sponsors a lot more now than I did when I was a more junior lawyer. I've done a lot of special committee work since becoming a partner, and that's in part just, I think, because of my interest in Delaware fiduciary law and Delaware case law. That's something that I built up as a more junior lawyer, but has been, I think, a good source of opportunity for me because it is something that I've focused on.
Talk about how you read Delaware case law, what you're looking for, and how you fit a given decision into the matrix of the case law that you know.
Well, it's helpful, I think, to have a pretty deep knowledge of that case law. You know, when I started at Debevoise in 1994, you know, the seminal cases from Delaware of the mid-80s, you know, your Household, your Unical, and the like, were not that old, right?
They were from 1985. They were less than a decade old.
Right. So you could go back, or Revlon, and you could go back and you could read all the cases that adjudicated the question of whether a company could maintain a poison pill, or, you know, or all the Revlon cases. And that would be a daunting task, I think, to do today, to go back and read every case since then. But then it was more manageable. So, you know, I think that one of the advantages I have is I have been reading these cases for 30 years. And so it does give you the ability, I think, to put a set of facts that you encounter into the context of all those decisions.
Talk a little bit about investment management deals.
I got involved in investment management deals just because of some of the clients of the firm and clients I worked on with Meredith Brown, who were investment managers. And part of the life cycle of investment management firms, you know, tended to involve M&A at some point. It was a rapidly consolidating business, especially in the later part of the 1990s. So that's how I got into it. And the things that I found interesting about it were that they're such ethereal businesses. They don't have factories. They have people. They're just pure human capital businesses, essentially. And the clients are not typically bound to the investment management firm by long-term contracts either. And so you can lose the clients, you can lose the people pretty easily. And so there's a real challenge in coming up with transaction structures that are designed both to deliver the firm that you thought you were buying or thought you were selling to the buyer, but also to try to preserve it intact so that the value is there. And those are challenging issues. And as a result of those challenges, there's a differentiated set of M&A technology that's used to deal with them. And then you layer on top of that the regulated businesses. And so that adds a layer of complexity. So I think they're really fun deals to work on. The people in that industry tend to be very, very bright people. They don't fear complexity. And that also has made deal-making fun.
Because in the standard public company M&A deal, the lawyers are pretty much worried about the period between signing and closing, and anything that happens after closing, that's the buyer's problem. But in investment management or in human capital businesses generally, in designing the legal arrangements between the target and the buyer, you have to think about what the target's most valuable employees are going to be doing after the deal closes, and how to best preserve that value for the buyer.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's also true when you're representing the target company or the target sellers, because they tend to have an ongoing economic interest in the success of the business, either because they keep minority equity stakes or because they have earnouts in the deal, or simply because their compensation is linked to the ongoing success of the business. And you know, a lot of the success of an investment management business tends to be attributable to some distinct culture that the firm has created and that they want to preserve. And sometimes that's at some conflict with what a buyer is trying to accomplish with an acquisition. But, you know, that's a delicate balance that you have to strike representing parties on either side.
As you've mentioned, you are an avid student of Delaware, and certainly the last year has been an extraordinarily unusual one in the history of Delaware law. You've had just earlier this week, we're talking on a Friday, and about 3 days ago, the Delaware governor signed into law amendments to the state's corporate code that were generated a fair amount of controversy. You had the same thing happen last year. What's your take on those amendments and where the state's law is now?
Well, I would say there's no doubt that Delaware practitioners viewed the reaction to some of the cases over the last year or two as representing an almost existential threat to their franchise as the preferred state of incorporation. And I'm not going to second guess that. I would say that even without this legislation, I would still rather be in front of a Delaware court than any other. And I would still recommend to clients that they incorporate in Delaware. And I say that because I do think it's the place where you have the best chance, if you're in a dispute, of being understood. You know, the courts have been dealing with the corporate law questions for so long and have such a deep institutional knowledge of it that the one thing you don't have to worry about is that the judge you're in front of is not going to understand what's going on. And that's not always true in every jurisdiction. And there's an incredible value in that. At the same time, there were aspects of the way the Delaware law had developed that created a fair amount of uncertainty. And I'm thinking in particular questions like who is a controller, or when is a director independent or not independent, that were very hard to predict sometimes because you had cases that found control at relatively small percentage stockholdings, or you had the concept that you could be not a controller in general, but you might be viewed as a controller with respect to a specific transaction. And those were very hard to evaluate and therefore hard to counsel on and to plan transactions around. And similarly, you had, I would say, a broadening of factors that a court might look at in deciding that a director either wasn't independent or at least that it had been plausibly alleged that a director was not independent. And the combination of those things made all the progress that Delaware had made in creating certainty around transactions by providing safe harbors such as MFW or even Corwin, so that if you had fully informed votes of stockholders, they weren't going to get second-guessed by the court. It made it hard to rely on those because you never knew exactly where you were in those. So I do think that those were important areas to address, and I'm glad they've addressed them.
And how do you evaluate just the risk of litigation and a litigation environment in Delaware going forward? Obviously, the plaintiff's bar was very critical of the most recent amendments. How do you think those lawyers will adjust in the months and years ahead?
I don't spend lots of time worrying about the fate of the plaintiff's lawyers. They will find a way. They always have. They were very vocal at the time of Trulia and Corwin's and MFW saying that was going to put them out of business. There were going to be no more questions to litigate in Delaware. They found questions to litigate in Delaware. And I think there will still be questions to litigate in Delaware. The safe harbors that Delaware is crafting through this recent legislation all depend on informed decisions by boards, good faith decisions by boards. They depend on informed votes by unaffiliated stockholders. And I think that plaintiffs will continue to challenge whether those predicates are met, whether the votes are in fact fully informed, whether the boards were acting in good faith or without gross negligence in deciding that a director was disinterested or was independent. So I think there will still be plenty of action for plaintiff's lawyers, but I think it will give greater certainty to people planning transactions. And that's a positive thing.
And then finally, talk a little bit about what you do to decompress from the job.
Well, I have lots of interests outside of my office. I like to read. I like to run. I play the guitar. I like to take photographs. I like bird watching. I combine those. I like to take pictures of birds. So I have plenty I can find to do when you don't find me here in my office.
What's the best book you've read in the last several months?
Let's see. I read Lily of the Valley by Balzac. And I really enjoy Balzac because I think it sounds many themes that are very relevant today. And I think he's also just a beautiful writer.
Bill, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, David.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.